This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins, and this is how most people know Vince Guaraldi. Or perhaps from music like this. Both are from Peanuts TV specials. Teaming jazz pianist Vince Guaraldi with Charlie Brown, Lucy, Linus, Schroeder, and Snoopy was pure genius, a marriage made in heaven. It also placed Guaraldi's music into the catalog of songs that comprise the soundtrack to Christmas. But Guaraldi was known in San Francisco at the time as Dr. Funk. More than the Peanuts piano guy, he was an accomplished jazz pianist and composer who worked with the likes of Cal Jader and Woody Herman and helped introduce pop music lovers to the bossa nova with his hit recording of Cast Your Fate to the Wind. Well, there are some in Charlotte who are determined to set the record straight while celebrating the music of Vince Guaraldi. They get together next Tuesday at the Booth Playhouse, and we have some of those responsible with us, or for that, with us this hour. Lonnie Davis is president and executive director of the Jazz Arts Initiative and an accomplished jazz flautist. Is it flautist or flutist when you're a jazz person?
It's flutist when you're it's a jazz person, yeah. We don't flout.
Do you flaunt? That's the question. Chad Lawson has been on this program several times in the past. He's a wonderful jazz pianist. And joining us by phone is Derek Bang, author of Vince Guaraldi at the Piano, a biography, as well as 50 Years of Happiness, a tribute to Charles M. Schulz. And he joins us where it's very early in the morning at Davis, California. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning to all of you.
This production coming up at the Booth is the product of an organization about which many people may know absolutely nothing. I don't think I knew anything about the Jazz Arts Initiative, mm-hmm. but you regularly produce shows, who knew, called Jazz Room at the Stage Door Theater, which is downstairs from the Booth at the corner of College and Fifth in the Performing Arts Center. How did all this begin?
Wow. Well, about 4 years ago, Jazz Arts Initiative was founded, we're a nonprofit organization right here in Charlotte, and our mission is to connect the community and develop a jazz audience through education, jazz education, jazz performance, and supporting local artists.
And you came here, I understand, after Katrina from New Orleans.
Yes.
Kind of displaced by the water.
Yes.
And so you've been here how long?
Been here for 7 years.
So how's it going? How is building a jazz audience? Because you're never going to have the audience you have for it in New Orleans. But
sure.
What's it like? What's it been like for you?
It's been great, and the response has been great. And surprisingly, there are lots of people in this community that really want, you know, a vibrant jazz scene. And so it's made our job, you know, fairly easy to put this programming in place.
And you do this about once a month, is that right?
Yes. Well, this series has been going on for roughly, this will be the ninth month. This is our second season. But Jazz Arts, of course, as I said earlier, we do other programs. And about 2.5 years ago, we presented Delphio Marsalis in concert right here at the McGlohan Theater. That was us.
And I think you may have been responsible for getting him on this program now that
Yes, I was in the studio, and we also presented Terrence Blanchard and as a part of the Swing Jazz series. So we've been doing some, you know, pretty cool things, if I could say so myself.
Yeah. And you usually put these, as I say, in the Stage Door Theater, which is downstairs from the Booth and
sure.
next door to the Belk. And Stage Door Theater is a kind of a perfect place for this because it's a black box, kind of a small room, mm-hmm. Kind of like a club.
Yeah, well, that's the point. Yeah, we try to convert that space into a jazz club type of.
But you've moved this for piano jazz with Vince Guaraldi. You've moved it upstairs to the Booth. Why?
Well, because we know that our Jazz Room series sells out every month, and so we knew that there'll be many more people than what the average room, that normal room, can actually hold, that would be interested in seeing this program. And it's also a benefit concert for Jazz Arts Initiative, so we wanted to give more people an opportunity to be a part of this program.
Derek, you've written a couple of books, as I said, about Charles M. Schulz, the cartoonist and the mastermind behind the Peanuts cartoon strip. But did you not first start paying attention to the Peanuts by watching the TV special when it first came on the air 150 years ago?
Well, maybe not quite that long, but yes. Like much of the United States that had TV sets, I vividly remember at the age of 10 being parked in front of ours in that December evening back in 1965, and my family and I were anxious to see the Peanuts characters leap off the newspaper page, and that was pretty much all we were expecting. The show starts, and it opens with that wonderful ice skating sequence that we all know and love, and the music. Even at the age of 10, I remember being transfixed by this music, and it just got better. We get to that wonderful pop jazz number when all the kids are dancing, excuse me, instead of putting on the Christmas show that they're supposed to be doing, and the credits unspool at the end of the show, and they zap past so quickly, I had absolutely no idea who had done that music. And like George Winston, who also was transfixed that day, a little bit older than I was at that time, he went haunting a record store the following day. It took me a little bit longer than that because at the age of 10 back then, I wasn't sophisticated enough to realize the possibility that somebody might put out a soundtrack to a TV special. So it took me a little bit longer, but when I finally realized there was a record to purchase, let's just say I wore the grooves off that puppy.
Yeah, it also took you a little while to write the book about Vince Guaraldi. And you've been fascinated with Vince Guaraldi since that night in 1965. So what took you so long to write the book, the biography?
Well, not too many 10-year-olds have ambitions like that grandiose. I grew up doing the usual fannish things. You buy the records by the guy with the name that you recognize. And then by the time I hit college, I began to realize that he had recorded with other individuals, notably Cal Chater. They made a bunch of albums together when Guaraldi was part of Chater's trio and quintet. And college kind of derailed me for a little bit, and then life gets in the way, and I continued to pay attention to what was going on, which wasn't much because, of course, he died in 1976. Yeah. And ironically, I wasn't to learn this until much later, when I was doing the research for the book, but he had actually performed at UC Davis, which is where I attended college, the year before I got there. So, and I talk about missed opportunities. I never did actually get to see him perform live. Cut ahead to the internet age, and I put together one of the first fan-based web pages with a little bit of information on him in the early 90s. And this drew the attention of George Winston, who got in touch with me, and we began to correspond. And when Winston performed an all Guaraldi music concert of his own in the late 90s, my wife and I attended, and George introduced us to David Guaraldi, Vince's son, who was there as well with his family. And that sort of planted the seed. At that point in time, I recognized that somebody had to do a book about Guaraldi, but I kept expecting that somebody on the inside would do it, somebody who had played with him, because many of his collaborators were still performing and well out in the world, as it were. But nobody was doing it. Nobody was doing it. And shortly after the turn of the century, somebody big in the jazz world died, and people keep asking me who it was, and I couldn't tell you. It wasn't anybody related to Guaraldi. But I realized the window was closing, and the opportunity to chat live, you know, interview a lot of these people who've been there back in the day in the 50s and 60s was fading, And I thought, well, okay.
It's now or never. Now Chad Lawson is here, and Chad, you have your own series of albums out, and you've played a variety of different styles. He mentioned George Winston. You've done kind of that new age style of music. You've also done traditional jazz. Vince Guaraldi, most people only think of him at this time of year because of the Christmas Peanuts thing. How aware were you of, or how influential is Vince Guaraldi on what you've done with your career?
Very much. Kind of going back to his point, which was, you know, it's my childhood was, you know, iconic with two music entities in a roundabout way. That's the Muppet Show and then, you know, Peanuts. You know, I mean, that's what I remember from my childhood as far as music is concerned. And you grow up with this nostalgic. These nostalgia memories of just this music connecting to you as you're watching this TV show, and you're not really understanding how it's working. And then as I've grown as a musician, I'm realizing that as a composer, you know, he was so able to connect to the listener as far as his compositions, and it's really mind-boggling because. And a roundabout way, they sound really simple, but then when you start, you know, picking them apart and actually playing them, they're like, that's not that simple. How does he do this? You know, and so he was able to create this sense of like skating. You know, the very first song that you had here on the
why don't
promo.
Why don't you put a little bit of skating or you can talk about how it works
sure.
in the show.
Well, I mean, the great thing about skating is it has this great little melody. You know, and it just. Instantly just kind of pulls you in, you know, and you've got this lyrical kind of and it just returns back to that. And you just there is no other picture that comes to mind except for skating.
Yeah. Well, you got 2 minutes to give us the demo. It's Chad Lawson. Only the best piano. We bring the best piano in the country in for you to play here.
It's a piano.
It was built in 1905.
Piano.
Chad Lawson, who will be among the pianists playing Piano Night with the music of Vince Guaraldi. We're going to come back in a second and talk about how this works, how this music of Vince Guaraldi works so magically in these Peanuts TV shows, because there was some controversy about whether or not that music should be in those TV shows. We'll talk about that as well when we come back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
And thanks for tuning in to this archive version of Charlotte Talks this morning. Happy holidays to everyone. This is 90.7 WFAE Charlotte, 90.3 WFHE Hickory, Charlotte's NPR news source. Our support today comes from WFAE members and Mr. Rogers Windows, a local family business since 1986, offering renewal by Anderson replacement windows and entry door systems. Installed by trained craftsmen, product details at MrRogersWindows.com. And thanks to all the generous listeners who contributed during our one-day on-air membership campaign. Though we fell short of our goal, it's not too late for you to help us make our annual goal by contributing to WFAE before December 31st. And take advantage of that last-minute tax deduction. Please call now at 704-549-9000 or contribute online at WFAE.org.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the best-selling author of Fried Green Tomatoes at the Whistle Stop Cafe returns with a new book about two strong women spanning generations. Actress-turned-writer Fannie Flagg on her latest novel.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning at 10 here on 90.7 WFAE.
Music there from Vince Guaraldi's trio back in the, the 60s with Bolasetti, the guitarist. You will not hear very much of in this particular section of the song, but he did a series of concerts and albums with him back then as a kind of a introduction of bossa nova to America. We're talking about Vince Guaraldi because there's going to be a piano night with Vince Guaraldi on Tuesday evening at the Booth Playhouse, and we associate Vince mostly with Christmas because of his association with the Peanuts specials. Derek Bang is the author of Vince Guaraldi at the Piano, a biography, and 50 Years of Happiness, a tribute to Charles M. Schulz. He joins us by phone from California. Chad Lawson is here sitting behind a wonderful piano that we bought just for him. He's a local pianist and composer, and Lonnie Davis is president and executive director of the Jazz Arts Initiative. They sponsor this upcoming concert and many others throughout the year. Derek, most of us think of Vince Guaraldi because of either Cast Your Fate to the Wind or the music that we hear behind these Peanut specials, most particularly the Christmas specials, because they seem to get repeated every single year. But he had a career apart from that association. As you delved into him for his biography, was that a surprise to you?
Actually, no, not at all. And I can get back to that by commenting on something that Chad mentioned a moment ago, and that would be Guaraldi's facility for melody. As part of the Cal Chater combos, and this was in the 1950s, and when you would attend one of these concerts at a jazz club and see these guys perform, this was a traditional thing where they'd jump into a particular tune and then each of the individuals would be given a solo. Mm-hmm. Guaraldi's solos were always mini melodies unto themselves. You felt like you could extract what he was doing and it would be a song in its own right. So from the very beginning, Guaraldi was demonstrating two talents. On the one hand, he could effortlessly pull these wonderful little tunes out of the air and enchant listeners with them. On the other hand, when the situation called for it, he could be a very hard bopper. And you get that in some of the sessions that he did with folks such as Frank Rosolino or Bill Holman or Conti Condoli, all of these people with whom he recorded in the late 1950s and early 60s. So he was much more talented musically than a lot of people give him credit for. There's no question of that. Mm.
But you have called him, you've said that his legacy is poorly acknowledged and woefully undervalued. And yet here you are, Lonnie, sponsoring a whole concert of the music of Vince Guaraldi. What about his music lit a fire in you?
You know, I am one of a number of people, many people that grew up with the Peanuts TV series. And and there was always something about watching Charlie Brown that was different for me. I loved watching cartoons, but watching Charlie Brown, and all of those shows, it was just something about the music. And I really didn't know at the time what it was. It was because I wasn't really used to playing and listening and hearing jazz behind a cartoon. It was just kind of different for me. And so I think that really stuck with me. and I think a lot of people. And so I think that music has, you know, really been ingrained in us.
I actually found it jarring when I first heard it. Because my exposure to Charlie, I've actually never really very much liked the Peanuts cartoon strip.
is this something they said?
No. I do like Snoopy, though. But I think my first exposure to music with Charlie Brown was You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, which was the Broadway, off-Broadway musical of it. And the style of that music is completely different from the style of this music. And when I heard this music under Charlie Brown, I thought, that's wrong. Mm-hmm. That's just wrong. And CBS thought that, too. Didn't they, Derek?
No, that's true. There were many things about that first television special that were considered awkward, starting with the religious content, which was absolutely unprecedented at that time. Gentle as it is now when we look back on it, it was considered quite controversial then. And then everybody of consequence hated the concept of jazz. And in fact, Lee Mendelson, who directed and produced the special, loves to tell the story about airing the finished show in front of the CBS brass with but weeks to go before it was scheduled to be broadcast. And they hated it. Mm-hmm. But they were stuck because production on the show had run so long that the ads had been taken out in newspapers, the listings were in TV Guide, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So they were stuck. And they said, well, you know, we're going to have to run it, but obviously there's never going to be another one. And, of course, history has indicated that then, as frequently now, TV executives don't have the faintest idea what they're talking about.
That is so true. Yeah, because I think it got a 50 share the first night that it aired, which meant that 50% of people watching television were watching that Peanuts special, and evidently they liked it because it's been back every year since.
Absolutely, although as Lee punctuates that same story, when he got a congratulatory phone call a few days later from one of those execs, there was a pause, and then the gentleman said, but my aunt still didn't like it.
One critic I read about Vince Guaraldi described him as a journeyman whose jazz career had was interrupted by a fluke hit, Cast Your Fate to the Wind.
Oh, that is so unfair.
Now, you're a kind of a journeyman jazz guy, Chad. You have your own trio, had your own trio. Maybe you still do. You've recorded with them. You recorded a couple of solo albums. And you've had a lot of airplay, particularly on the first album with the Chad Lawson Trio. That guy, I heard that everywhere, in elevators. And I don't mean that to be insulting.
Right.
It was and on TV shows like sure. Dawson's Creek, they played it. What's it like to be a guy who goes into clubs for a couple hundred bucks a night and plays, and then suddenly your music is everywhere? Because that was his experience.
Well, I mean, there's a couple of great points to this, and I think Vince Guaraldi kind of had this in mindset. I think this may be the case, and please, Derek, correct me if I'm incorrect. To where he wrote the music, and it wasn't to, he wrote what he had inside of him. So it wasn't like he was like, okay, I'm going to write something that's really poppy and whatever is trendy right now, and I'm going to go, you know, exactly where the trend is going. You know, trend is friend, you know. And from what I read with Cast Your Fate Against to the Wind, yeah, that it was just kind of like a B-side. Like the DJ, you know, found this record and it was on the other side. And he was like, oh, what's this? And let me check it out. And, you know, going back to the story of the Peanuts and people not liking the jazz and it did so well, I think there's really something to be said about artists or whoever, you know, any kind of creative work, of really going with what you're passionate about and what's your gut, and kind of going against what, you know, Bill Cosby says that the key to, you know, the key to failure is to please everybody. And I really so agree with that. So that makes me so happy to hear about the whole story with the Peanuts, and about, you know, they wanted to take the jazz out, and then lo and behold, it, you know, becomes so iconic. And
well, he has a couple of things like that. As you mentioned, the Cast Your Fate to the Wind, it was the flip side. He was trying to capitalize on this bossa nova popularity, and there had been a movie, help me out here, Derek, a movie about Black Orpheus.
Right. Black Orpheus hit the United States in late 1959, and a lot of people were watching it in very early 1960, and Guaraldi went and saw the film and was just entranced by the soundtrack by Antonio Carlos Jobim and Louis Bonfa. And so he started shopping around his concept of his own jazz arrangements of the four primary themes in that movie. And he tried, at this particular point in time, he didn't have a contract with Fantasy because he had released two of his own albums on Fantasy and they had not sold very well and Fantasy had dropped him. Mm-hmm. So he shopped this idea to Capitol and Columbia, both of whom passed. And then came back to Fantasy, and by coincidence, Max Weiss, who was running Fantasy at the time, had been thinking along the lines of capitalizing somehow on the growing bossa nova craze that was typified by this film. So he said okay, and gave Giraldi a one-album contract. Well, as it happened, the music from the film that Giraldi put together only filled one side of the album. So on the second side, he added four more tunes, two of which were originals, one of which was Cast Your Fate to the Wind. Now, Jerry Grinnelli, who was working as a drummer with Giraldi at this point in time, loves to tell this story about how Giraldi fought tooth and nail to get Cast Your Fate to the Wind put on the B-side of the 45 that was released to promote the album. Fantasy wanted the A-side to be Samba de Orpheus to bring the tie to the film out to the public. Giraldi went into the office, Max's office, and stood on his desk and threw things and pitched a fit, and they finally relented. So the record drops in April 1962. The 45 goes out at the same time, and nothing, and I mean nothing, happened for almost 6 months. Mm. Now, can you imagine that today? in the atmosphere that we have now, that a record would continue to be out there trying to attract attention almost half a year later? The way things happen at an accelerated pace today, it just doesn't move that way. But back then, things were more leisurely. And then, yes, the magic moment. It was right here in Sacramento, not too far from where I live, where a DJ at KROY was listening to all of the 45s that came in, and he played the A side of this one, and he flipped it over, and he loved the B side. And so he started playing it a lot, as much as he could get away with, given the very strict play parameters under which radio DJs operated at that time. They could not play a given album more, given record more than X number of times in a two-hour block. But he was sneaky. As they approached the end of the hour, when you're leading up to the news and you only have maybe a minute, minute and a half, and you're going to have to fade something out, he'd play Cast Your Fate to the Wind, fade out into the news. So, it got to be something that people were hearing a lot. And Giraldi finally got a call one day from Fantasy Records, and he heard those magic three words that every artist dreams of were getting action. It started in Sacramento, and then Los Angeles, and then San Diego, and San Francisco. And then it just started spreading across the country. And as of December 1962, Cast Your Fate to the Wind entered the pop music chart, way at the bottom of the list. And for the first half of 1963, it just kept climbing.
Yep, and he won a Grammy for it, and he also got the Peanuts gig because of that. As I understand it, the producers had approached, they were doing a documentary before they did the Peanuts shows that we know now. And the producer had approached, I think, Dave Brubeck.
Yep.
And who else?
Cal Tjader.
Cal Tjader. And they said, no, they were too busy. Now, I don't know whether they said whether they were really busy or they just didn't want to get involved in a documentary that was never going to see the light of day. But they said no. And he was crossing the Golden Gate Bridge, the producer was, and heard this on the radio and
Absolutely correct.
Vince Guaraldi down.
Isn't that amazing?
His life is filled with serendipity, isn't it?
Oh, it's just astonishing. And, of course, the great irony to this story is that the documentary they were working on, which was sort of made in the mold of A Day in the Life of Charles M. Schulz, and it had a little bit of animation attached to it, done by Bill Melendez, who would go on to animate all of the early Peanuts specials. And they went ahead and hired Giraldi to do the music, and that show was finished and shopped around, and it never sold.
You know, some of the music in the Peanuts specials, particularly the Christmas special, which has gone on to become a classic Christmas music, I wouldn't even think of it as jazz, Chad. And one of them, Christmas Time Is Here, is a nice, slow, ballad? Where would you put it? How would you categorize it?
Yeah, I wouldn't really. I'd almost call it as a Christmas standard more than I would like a jazz standard. You know, it's a Christmas song that, you know, everyone is so used to it being in the holidays now. I mean, it's hard not to hear the song and not consider it to be a Christmas standard.
That's an interesting distinction, because at one point in time when Guaraldi was interviewed shortly after achieving fame with Cast Your Fate to the Wind, he was asked if he hoped to write another hit. And his reply, I thought, was very prescient. He said, well, it's wonderful to write hits, but what I'd really like to do is write a standard.
Mm.
And the beauty of that, the sad, poignant beauty of that, is that although he never saw this happen in his lifetime, he definitely achieved that wish, because, as Chad said, there's no question that Christmas Time Is Here has become and will remain a standard.
So let's hear it. Let's hear the standard, one of the standards that he's responsible, because he's responsible for more than one, but here's one of them, because it's Christmas time.
I mean, lyrically, you know, going back to Derek's point, he was such a master at creating just lyrics that when you walk down the sidewalk, you can still sing it in your head. You can still whistle it when you're away from the radio or from the TV show.
And what you hear in your head, I think, are those kids singing that song, and they're not professionals. And the voices that do the Peanuts in the early Peanuts specials were not professional child actors. Another thing that CBS hated about it. Because they weren't professionals, and they wanted professional voices in there, and that's what makes it charming.
There's a rawness about it.
Yeah. Lonnie, you're a musician, and you're a jazz aficionado, and you're a jazz event producer. Vince Guaraldi, put him in context with all the other people whose music you promote.
You know, I think he's an unsung, you know, just super talented composer, pianist, musician. I think he's overlooked. I think, in a sense, he's a musical genius because he has the sound, this Vince Guaraldi sound that's undeniable, no matter what style he played, you know, whether it was his electric band or, you know, whether it was the Peanuts or, you know, the bossa nova stuff that he did. It's undeniable when you listen to him, you know that you're listening to Guaraldi because of the quality the music that he did. And, you know, some of his music had a tinge of a somber, you know, kind of a melancholy feel, but, you know, it always swung. It was always in the pocket.
We have to take a break. We're coming back with more in just a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Hope you're enjoying this archived Christmas version of Charlotte Talks here on 90.7 WFAE listener-funded public radio. Coming up in 20 minutes on the Diane Rehm Show, Diane talks with author, actor, and comedian Fanny Flagg about her latest book. It's a comic mystery novel about two women who are forced to imagine who they are. That's Diane Rehm at 10 o'clock. And support for our programming this morning comes from WFAE members and Charlotte Magazine, now celebrating its 45th anniversary. Subscriptions to Charlotte City Magazine are available online at charlottemagazine.com. Sunny skies today in Charlotte with a high expected around 42 degrees tonight. mostly clear skies in the evening, then becoming mostly cloudy and a low near 25. And right now in Charlotte, it's 28 degrees.
In 2013, WFAE brought you the news you count on more than ever. And we are committed to doing the same in 2014 with your help. That support can come in many forms, including a donation of stock or a used vehicle. To make your gift or to learn more, please call us at 704-549-9000 or visit us online at WFAE.org.
Lucy, when you hear that, you can see the animation. You can see Linus and Lucy walking down the street. And I'm wondering, Derek, if you know, when he did the music, had he seen the animation prior to writing the songs?
Oh, absolutely not. In fact, there's a wonderful story about how Linus and Lucy came about. Shortly after the anecdote that you mentioned, when Lee Mendelson was driving across the Golden Gate Bridge and heard Cast Your Fate to the Wind on the radio, got in touch with Fantasy Records, who subsequently put him in touch with Vince Guaraldi, who accepted the gig to put some swing in Charlie Brown's step, as it were. A couple weeks later, Mendelson got a call on the phone, and it was Guaraldi on the other end, saying, I want to play something for you right now. And Lee said, okay, I'll drive right over, and you can play it for me. And Guaraldi said, no, you don't understand. I have to play it for you now. Now, the backstory, the backstory to this and the reason Guaraldi was behaving this way is that he neither read nor wrote music very well in the classical sense. When he wanted to save something, he taped himself. So when he said he had to play something for Lee now on the phone, he really meant it. He went on to say, he knew that Lee knew music. He said, if I play it for you on the phone, you'll hear it, and if I happen to forget it, you'll be able to hum it back to me. And so he played a few bars of what would become Linus and Lucy. Now, I suspect that Lee has made the story a bit more apocryphal as time has gone by, but he insists that when he heard that music, he thought, you know, this is going to be bigger than I thought it was, because he was immediately taken by that tune. And how can you not be?
Yeah, it's interesting to know that you say that, and there are other musicians who have gone on to be great stars. Frank Sinatra couldn't read music. It's fascinating to think that somebody who's that prolific and that good could not read music, but it also plays into a quote that I read yesterday about him, that he's not a pianist. He is a piano player. A pianist is somebody who can sit down and play something that's put in front of him, and a piano player is someone who can sit down and play it before he sees it.
Yeah, that's a wonderful quote, yeah. And it's often used with respect to Guaraldi.
Lonnie, you're putting together this night of Vince Guaraldi music, and I'm curious as to what you've told the musicians that are going to be assembled there on Tuesday night. Are they going to be there just to give their take on Vince Guaraldi, or are they there to duplicate Vince Guaraldi?
They are certainly there to put their flavor on the music of Vince Guaraldi. As all of our jazz room concerts go, we do tributes to different jazz musicians, different legendary artists, and so this month it is a tribute to Vince Guaraldi, and so they will be doing their renditions of Vince Guaraldi holiday music. And I will add that there will be some other holiday classics with jazz flavor as well. But the night is all about Vince Guaraldi, and they will be putting their flavors.
So what does that do? You're one of the pianists who have been asked to participate in this, Chad. So when you're sitting down to play either... Well this guy's... The stuff that you're being asked to play is iconic. So what do you do? What kind of a pressure does that put on you?
Yeah, you don't take it lightly by any stretch of the imagination. You're still trying to give respect to, you know, Vince Guaraldi, of course, but also trying to put your fingerprint on it as well, without deviating too far away from, you know, Vince's original mindset, from his original, you know, what he intended it for it to be. So it's more of an honor because, I mean, something like this, you know, with Vince's compositions, you don't want to mess them up, you know, because, I mean, they are iconic for that reason. I hate to use that word again, but it's so true. I mean, he was able to write something that it doesn't need changing. It doesn't need to be, you know, fancied up or prettied up or manipulated.
And I think you have another holiday favorite that that you are prepared to. And we don't have Andy Williams here, so it's just you.
It's just me.
It's just you, Chad.
Well, yeah, his flight was delayed.
I'd say.
This is kind of towards the season, the most wonderful time of year. So just kind of a...
Yeah, Chad Lawson.
Thanks,
in your take on Most Wonderful Time of the Year, it's kind of it's a little blend in there of what you've gravitated toward in your career. It seems to me where you started out as a typical jazz trio kind of pianist into this, for lack of a better term, new age music that you've put out in the last couple of albums on.
Yeah, I've been calling it alternative classical. Actually, is what I'm trying to coin it as. That's my that's actually on my Christmas album. Going back to Vince Guaraldi real quick, I mean, I think the reason why listeners were so able to connect with him is that he was actually able to play music. I mean, he had, like, this incredible ability. He could play hard bop. You know, he could do all the angry jazz, and he could, like, really try to outplay each other. And I think what he realized is that's not what affects people. You know, he was able to write music that people actually wanted to listen to and enjoy. And it was funny because I was reading something where somebody asked him, do you ever get tired of playing, you know, Cash Your Fate? And he goes, no, I enjoy it. Why would I get tired of playing something that makes people happy?
That's Chad Lawson, jazz pianist and composer and frequent guest on this program. Derek Bang, author of Vince Guaraldi at the Piano, a biography, who joined us by phone. And Lonnie Davis, president and executive director of the Jazz Arts Initiative. Close this special Christmas Day edition of Charlotte Talks the way we've done it the last several years, and that's with a poem I discovered about 15 years ago. It was written by Minnesota actor and author Tom Hegg for a Christmas program at his church. When he was asked to speak, he agonized over what to write. He couldn't seem to come up with anything to say until the night before, when it all came rushing out onto one of those yellow legal pads. The next day, he walked to the lectern to read what he'd written. The church was filled to overflowing, but when he finished, he left the stage, he told me, to stony silence. He thought that he'd bombed, but actually, He had struck a chord in the congregation, a deep one. After a moment, the applause started and built and lingered. It turned out that the people listening to that first reading were simply too moved to respond right away, too caught up in their own thoughts about what he had read. But when they finally did respond, they leapt to their feet. Well, Tom Haig went on to publish his poem. It met with phenomenal success, and in many places, like here, the reading of A Cup of Christmas Tea has become an anticipated annual event.
The log was in the fireplace, all spiced and set to burn. At last, the yearly Christmas race was in the clubhouse turn. The cards were in the mail, all the gifts beneath the tree, and 30 days reprieve till Visa could catch up with me. And though smug satisfaction seemed the order of the day, something still was nagging me and would not go away. A week before, I got a letter from my old great aunt. It read, "Of course I'll understand completely if you can't, but if you find you have some time, how wonderful if we could have a little chat and share a cup of Christmas tea." She'd had a mild stroke that year, which crippled her left side. Though housebound now, my folks had said it hadn't hurt her pride. They said she'd love to see you. What a nice thing it would be for you to go and maybe have a cup of Christmas tea. But boy, I didn't want to go. Oh, what a bitter pill to see an old relation and how far she'd gone downhill. I remembered her as vigorous, as funny, and as bright. I remembered Christmas Eve's when she regaled us half the night. I didn't want to risk all that. I didn't want the pain. I didn't need to be depressed. I didn't need the strain. And what about my brother? Why not him? She's his aunt, too. I thought I had to justify, but then before I knew the reasons not to go, I so painstakingly had built were cracking wide and crumbling in an acid rain of guilt. I put on boots and gloves and cap, shame stinging every pore. And armed with squeegee, sand, and map, I went out my front door. I drove in from the suburbs to the older part of town. The pastels of the newer homes gave way to gray and brown. I had that disembodied feeling as the car pulled up and stopped beside the wooden house that held the Christmas cup. How I got up to her door, I really couldn't tell. I watched my hand rise up and press the button of the bell. I waited, aided by my nervous rocking to and fro. And just as I was thinking I should turn around and go, I heard the rattle of the china in the hutch against the wall, the triple beat of 2 feet, and a crutch came down the hall. The clicking of the door latch and the sliding of the bolt, and a little swollen struggle popped it open with a jolt. She stood there, pale and tiny, looking fragile as an egg. I forced myself from staring at the brace that held her leg, and though her thick bifocals seemed to crack and spread her eyes, their milky and refracted depths lit up with young surprise. "Come in, come in," she laughed the words, and she took me by the hand, and all my fears dissolved away as if by her command. We went inside, and then before I knew how to react, before my eyes and ears and nose was Christmas past, alive, intact. The scent of candied oranges, of cinnamon and pine, the antique wooden soldiers in their military line, the porcelain nativity I'd always loved so much, the Dresden and the crystal I'd been told I mustn't touch. My spirit fairly bolted like a child out of class and danced among the ornaments of calico and glass. Like magic, I was 6 again, deep in a Christmas spell, steeped in the million memories the boy inside knew well. And here among old Christmas cards so lovingly displayed, a special place of honor for the ones we kids had made. And there, beside her rocking chair, the center of it all, my great aunt stood and said how nice it was I'd come to call. I sat and rattled on about the weather and the flu. She listened very patiently, then smiled and said, "What's new?" Thoughts and words began to flow. I started making sense. I lost the phony breeziness I use when I get tense. She was still passionately interested in everything I did. She was positive, encouraging, like when I was a kid. Simple generalities still sent her into fits. She demanded the specifics, the particulars, the bits. We talked about the limitations that she'd had to face. She spoke with utter candor and with humor and good grace. Then, defying the reality of crutch and straightened knee, on wings of hospitality, she flew to brew the tea. I sat alone with feelings that I hadn't felt in years. I looked around at Christmas through a thick, hot blur of tears. And the candles and the holly she'd arranged on every shelf. The impossibly good cookies that she still somehow baked herself. But these rich, tactile memories became quite pale and thin when measured by the Christmas my great aunt kept deep within. Her body halved and nearly spent. But my great aunt was whole. I saw a Christmas miracle. The triumph of the soul. The triple beat of 2 feet and a crutch came down the hall. The rattle of the china in the hutch against the wall. She poured 2 cups. She smiled, and then she handed one to me. And then we settled back and had a cup of Christmas tea.
That's our special Christmas edition of Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. For Wendy Herkey, Tim Ross, Aaron Kiever, Alexi Girodi, and the entire staff of WFAE, we hope you have a happy holiday.